Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Fanzine podcast. Just before we get started with the show, this is your host Tony Fletcher. I want to invite you to sign up for the weekly newsletter over at tonyfletcher.substack.com. It'll give you updates on this podcast, my other podcasts, all forms of recommendations with a midweek update, a long form weekend read. Sign up is absolutely free. There are interview archives, additional podcast features, and you will be able to see more of the fanzines that we're talking about on this show. That's tonyfletcher.substack.com. Thanks again. Now on with the pod. Welcome, everybody, to episode 24 of the Fanzine podcast, which in many ways should go back to its original name just for this episode, the Jamming Fanzine podcast, because later on, after a few minutes, we're going to revisit the inaugural episode of this show, which was all about the birth of jamming. At the time, it was called From Classroom to Clubs, but in this particular episode, I'm going to call it The Birth of Jamming or The Birth of a Fanzine. You'll see which it is in the actual title. It feels appropriate to do so on this particular episode for a couple of reasons. Primarily, I am in the UK, which is where it all started. I am currently in Beverley, East Riding of Yorkshire, where I was born. I was here for my mother's 90th birthday. And she was important in jamming, as many people who know me understand and recognise. Very, very, very supportive and pretty hip and cool as well. And I'm sticking around for a little bit, and I'm fully planning on conducting some interviews for future episodes in person, or at least in the same time zone, while I'm over here. And yet, partly because of planning this trip and how busy I was the first couple of weeks, such interviews have not yet been conducted. And rather than keep you waiting for a new episode, I'm figuring quite a few people may not have heard about the initial episode. They may not have gone all the way back to it. And it's of interest right now for the various reasons of sort of revisiting childhood and some childhood places. And when I get a little bit closer to that episode, I'll name check the friends and explain a little bit more. But this has also been quite a fanzine fueled adventure so far in the UK, and I thought I would take the opportunity to provide a couple of updates on what's been going on. If you listen to the last episode, episode 23, the interview with Mark Perry, who of course founded Sniffing Glue and set the paved the way for people like me as a little school kid several years younger than him to feel that there was space for me to start a little zine as well. It was a good interview, and it was very, very, very well received. At the same time, we had suffered with the lack of video because of what seemed to be an interminably bad connection. And the Tuesday after I arrived here, I went to an event at which Mark Perry was interviewed by another future guest of this show, the wonderful James Brown, formerly of Attack on Pizzag, but many people know him as the founder and editor of Loaded, of course. He was on episode 16 of this podcast, along with Mark Hodkinson, also from Yorkshire, who I'm hoping to see while I'm over here. And the event was, of course, to coincide with the republication of the Sniffing Glue Compendium by Omnibus Press, who also published The Best of Jamming. It was held at the Walthamstow Trade Hall as part of a rock and roll book club event, and it was really, really, really well attended. I love being there, and Mark, in person, it made me wish a little bit that we had been able to do the interview and seen each other, because that one-on-one interaction made for a very energetic, really energetic hour and a half. And there aren't many people who can prevent James Brown getting a word in sideways, but Mark was on a roll. He was on an absolute roll. He was funny. He was incisive. As per when I interviewed him, I don't know that I agree with everything he says about which musicians should give up and which ones are doing doing the right thing by carrying on. But of course, that's part of the fanzine ethos, isn't it? We all have opinions, and as long as we can back them up and we're having maybe just a little bit of fun with it, and Mark was smiling and laughing and making people laugh all the time, then it's all good, right? So it was a good, like I say, it was a great event. There were other fanzine editors there, past fanzine editors, I should say. One of them was Alistair Mackay. He was on episode 19 of this show, along with Bobby Bluebell. That one was called Postcard from Post-Punk Scotland. Alistair used to contribute to Jamming, but we weren't actually sure we'd ever met before because he used to contribute by mail long before he moved to London. So that was lovely. And I also have to say that while I was honoured to be referenced as fanzine royalty while there, it was great when I showed up and I was on the guest list. It's like, oh, that's really nice. But I actually got announced as such at the introduction to the event. I was definitely a little bit embarrassed by that because it was really all about Mark being interviewed by James. And I also hadn't intended to sit in the front row, but my childhood friend, who was also born in Beverley, Pascal, he's a great guy. He's done a lot of self-publishing things over the years. And he was there and he saved a seat in the front row, right in front of the speaker, which was utterly wonderful for my tinnitus / tinnitus. I had to wear earplugs throughout the event, which is not punk rock of me, but I need to hold on to what hearing I have left for the time I have left. So if you haven't yet checked out the previous episode, please do. If you haven't yet checked out the Sniffing Glue Compendium, please do, because, of course, that set the scene for the punk fanzines. And while I'm over here, there's, well, I should say, it's when I got to Beverley, I got a lovely book waiting for me that we're going to definitely do an episode dedicated to this book, which is just out in the UK and coming out in the States, I believe, in June. It's called Xerox Machine, Punk, Post-Punk and Fanzines in Britain, 1976 to 88, very close to the dates on the Best of Jamming cover, which are 77 to 86. It's by Matthew Worley, who is a professor of modern history at the University of Reading. And yeah, to some extent, this is an academic book, to some extent. In the US, it's being published by Chicago University Press. In the UK, however, it's being published by Reaction Books with a K, Reaction with a K, which is way more punk rock. And Matthew's a great guy. He hosts a really good page on Facebook, a group, which is called Subcultures and... I should get the title up, shouldn't I? Anyway, he hosts a really good Facebook group. I'll put the link in the show notes, okay? And he really knows what he's doing. He's been very, very helpful to me as well, actually, in terms of my own research. And what I've read of this book is excellent. I've read the part about sniffing glue. I've read the part about jamming, and it seems pretty much spot on. So I'm looking forward to all the rest of it. It's amazing how many fanzine books are in my library back home in the States already. I'll be happy to add this one to it. I'm really looking forward to having Matthew on maybe in the next episode. Just want to make sure the book is out in both markets, or just about to be out before we do it. There's a lot in there, a lot in there. And interestingly, on page 97, the jamming cover he chose to reproduce to write about jamming is, in fact, not jamming. It's the initial issue, the school fanzine I did, like when I just didn't know anything about anything on how to do this, called In the City. My stick figure drawings are immortalized here. I spent decades actually hiding this from public view, but it's in an academic book now, so maybe I should not have been hiding it after all. And it's partly because of that that I am going to revisit that debut episode of this podcast, where with my school friends Richard Hurd and John Matthews and my great friend Jenny DeHart from the girls' school down the road, we talk about our formative years and how sort of punk changed us and what it was like growing up in the late 1970s, which was really a truly incredible time. And the more that time goes on, the more I realise just, A, how fortunate I was, we were, and how much the world has changed. Not the only fanzine waiting for me. There were a couple of issues of Confessions of an Ex-Editor, which I'd had sent here because international postage is so expensive now. Confessions of an Ex-Zine Editor is the title of episode 17 of the fanzine podcast, and that featured Alison, who likes to just go by the name Alison because she's writing about her addiction, past addictions, and it's some sort of meta fanzine. Really happy to get those because it's such an incredible zine. She is looking to have little guest pages by people who don't want to restart their zines, but maybe don't mind doing a page of like revamping their zine. She's asked me, I just think I'm too busy, but you go do it. You go do it. So again, look out for a link in show notes or over at my Substack. And I've also written a lot on the Substack about being over here in the UK. And I hope you will visit that because I just do. It's where I do all my writing now for dedicated readers, tonyfletcher.substack.com. I'm also looking to do an episode on football fanzines, and I've got a couple of issues of the City Gent, which is a Bradford City fanzine. It's been going for about 30 years, and you know, it's colour. It's like almost like an alternative programme, but its covers are cartoons, and it's got some wonderful articles. It's all sort of volunteer driven, and I'm looking to match Mike from City Gent up with a fanzine editor of one of the big six football clubs, where, you know, the clubs are incredibly well-funded. They expect success, but the fans are still dedicated fans who probably at certain times feel alienated from that club and maybe in some ways have all the more reason to be doing fanzines. And we're still waiting to line up the other person. But having said that, I went out to the local WH Smiths here, which always used to be the high street news agent. When Jamming got in Smiths, that was a really, really big deal. I picked up a copy of When Saturday Comes, the football fanzine that launched all the football fanzines back in the 80s. And still, despite its success and sitting on the shelves alongside all the glamorous football zines, and I should say glossy, really, has that fanzine ethos. It's printed on thin paper, and it really, to me, feels still, after all this time, like a fanzine. So who knows, maybe we'll end up interviewing the editor of When Saturday Comes for that one. I'm also hoping to do something on the dance magazine scene with the editors of Faith, possibly with another zine. So as you can see, I'm busy here doing that. I also wanted to give a shout out to The Big Issue. I don't know where fanzines start and end. You know, this is an eternal question. What constitutes a fanzine? The Big Issue is, of course, for those who live in the UK will know, it's it was started a long time ago as a way for homeless people, primarily homeless people, to get back on their feet by having a legitimate reason to stand on the street and ask for money, by selling a sort of DIY small edition paper called The Big Issue. And they get to keep 50% of the proceeds, but they're also part of a program that helps ensure that they, you know, that they have the support they need to spend that money wisely. I bought a copy in Beverly. I had a lovely chat with the guy who was selling it. I almost conned him out of my £10 note by chatting so thoroughly, but he was wise to it, which I'm glad about, because it felt like I was trying to pull a Ryan O'Neill from Paper Moon on him, which I really, really, really wasn't. So we laughed about that. The Big Issue remains utterly excellent. It's just like When Saturday Comes. It still feels like a zine. It's political. It's got music. It talks about the price of concert tickets, which is relevant. Talks about a new BBC show called This Town that's set in Coventry in 1981 at the peak of Two Tone. Yeah, it's really, really good. And on that issue of, and I don't mean to use the pun, but I just did, of what constitutes a fanzine? Where does it start? Where does it end? Going back to Matthew Worley's book, Xerox Machine, he notes something I did not know, that in early, because I had this question last time round, you know, what are the three small publications that Mark Perry referenced as inspirations for Sniffing Glue? And we did get a winner, and that winner went out through my Substack. And congratulations to Thorum for being that winner and getting the answers right. But it turns out that Melody Maker, earlier in 1976, ahead of Mark's starting Sniffing Glue, and maybe he didn't know about this, had actually run a special story about small publications, and they called them fanzines, even though none of them are what we would now constitute as a fanzine, really. They were kind of small publications. And as Matt rightly notes, they didn't look like what we think as zines. They may have been self-published. They may have been dedicated to a particular band or a style of music, from reggae to prog rock. But they didn't have the fanzine ethos that Mark kind of got going for us. And it was because of a similar spread in the what Matthew calls the populist magazine Sounds, the weekly Sounds, about a year and a half later, at the end of summer of 77, so just over a year later, by John Savage, the great writer John Savage, that inspired me to start a fanzine at school. I asked my friend John Matthews, he declined. I asked another friend, Lawrence Weaver, he accepted. And my best school friend, Richard Hurd, never really wrote for Jamming, but he was very much around me. My friend, Jenny DeHart, who I got to know in 79, she would help sell zines. She's actually going to be joining my band, The Dear Boys, in the studio next week. So these friendships survive. Richard lives in Scotland. I'm going to visit him on this trip. Haven't yet seen John. I intend to. I have seen Jenny, and it's always great. And I just thought this would be a wonderful time to revisit that inaugural episode. And while it's not all about Jamming, and I think that's a good thing, it's really not that much about Jamming. It's about the scene, and I really hope you enjoy it. And the next one will be one of those recorded in the UK, and I hope you'll stick around, subscribe, like, share, review, and please do come over to the Substack, because that's where you can get much more writing about all of this subculture. See you over there. Cheers. Bye-bye.
It's the Jamming
Fanzine
Podcast.
I mean, the thing about a fanzine was holding it in your hand, right? And looking at the way it had been put together and the punk way it had been put together, quite frankly. And it had a staple in it, you know? And that is a fanzine, right?
In late 1977, as a school kid in South London, inspired by the DIY culture of punk, I started a music zine. I had no long-term plan, and certainly no idea that over the next decade, Jamming would grow to become a national, even an international monthly magazine.
But that you would actually go and interview Pete Townsend? It's like, what? Yeah, I mean, how did you... And McCartney? It's like, no, you're a fanzine. You're not supposed... No, that was amazing. That's what completely marked you out.
And I certainly could not have imagined that in 2021, there would be a full-colour book collecting together what we have called the best of Jamming, selections and stories from the fanzine that grew up, 1977 to 86.
You know, when I look at in the book, when you talk to Madness, we'd really let our guard down a little bit there. I think that's the great thing of fanzines, that people relax a little bit more, musicians relax a little bit more, and you get a little bit more out of them, I think.
For the Jamming Fanzine podcast, I'm hosting conversations with some of these former contributors, photographers, musicians, scenesters, and school friends, and seeing if we can't, through the rose-tinted glasses of history, offer some sort of perspective on the heady days of that heavyweight decade.
It was just the joy of going, yeah, this is really good. There are some really good interviews in here. There's all sorts of bands in here. You should see it. What is it? Oh, it's a fanzine. Yeah, great. Because there are a few around, but none, obviously, that I thought was as good as Jamming. Do you want to buy a copy of Jamming?
Episode 1, From Classroom to Clubs.
We're going to do this podcast old school fanzine style. A quick intro to set the scene, followed by a cut-and-paste Q&A, complete with audio Tippex marks, and that's your lot. So let's set the scene by asking the question. What was it like to become a teenager in the late 1970s new wave world of central London? For me, it meant starting a band and a fanzine. For my old school friends Richard Hurd, John Matthews and Jenny DeHart, it meant being part of that journey. And for this first episode of the Jamming Fanzine podcast, it means me falling back into my old Cockney accent and reuniting with the three of them on Zoom to talk not just about jamming, but about the culture of the amazing times we lived through and the freedoms we took for granted. In true fanzine style, I'm going to say that pretty much everything you need to know about the conversation that follows is in the conversation that follows. Except to state that our boys' school, Archbishop Tennyson's, was up at Kennington Oval. Jenny's girls' school, CEB, was just off the Camberwell New Road. Apocalypse was the name of my old band. And the Music Machine gig you hear mentioned at the very end of the show took place in December 1980. And for what it's worth, these days I live in New York, Richard lives in Scotland, and Jenny and John are still flying the flag for South London. Despite the distance, we do get to see each other. So with all that, it's time to bring back the aroma of spray paint, cowgum, Tippex and nicotine and head on back to where and when it all began. Welcome, everybody. It's a Friday evening over in England. It's a Friday afternoon here. And I figured that we might get some mileage out of having a little podcast series about the story of jamming fanzine / magazine. And where better to start than with my oldest friends, which I mean both sort of literally and figuratively, and hooking up, if that's the right term, with some of my old school friends who were not only around the start of the story of jamming, but have all contributed to the Best of Jamming book in the foreword one after another. So I'm going to ask you each to introduce yourselves. And apparently, I was just informed I'm the oldest person in the room right now, which I think is marginal. So let's go from the youngest through to the next oldest. So if you know what order that is, introduce yourself. Maybe if you remember, if your memory goes back that far, when did we meet?
Well, I know I'm the youngest because I obviously look the youngest. So I'll start this one. So I'm Richard Hurd. And I've known Tony, I think, since we were 11, when we started Archbishop Tennyson's together. And I think, John, we probably met around the same time. Jen, we bumped into each other on a bus that pulled up outside the school when we were 14 on our way to France, I believe. So
in May 1979, yes.
That's right. So 1979, a good year and very relevant for this conversation. So, yeah, great to see you all.
Great. Yeah, so that's Richard. So who's next? Who's next up in age, then?
That's me. Oh. Just by one day, John. I'm yes, one day younger than you. So
you keep reminding me, Jen. I'm
Jenny DeHart. I went to Charles Edward Brooke Grammar School for Girls, nearly a mile down the road from the boys' school where these three went. And, well, Tony and I have met first. We didn't really know each other, but we used to get the number 3 bus home, both living in West Dulwich. So I kind of knew him by sight, but we had lots of joint school productions because our school's twinned with doing a lot of stuff like the annual musical production. Tony would have been in the orchestra.
That's my punk credibility shot immediately. We should scratch this and start all over again. I was probably playing the cello as well.
Yeah, so we properly met that day in 1979 when we all were on a coach going to France for the annual French exchange, and we were in the fourth year, so it was, and we were still all 14 at the time. Oh no, Tony, you would have just turned 15. Yeah. And we headed off to Nantes where we were having French kids around,
and it was wonderful. And there's a picture of it, actually there's two pictures of us there in the book. John, you're in one of those pictures as well. So when did we all meet, John?
Same time as Rich. I must have met you and Richard around about the same time, when I was about 11, when we were in the same class at school. I think it's kind of important to say that although sport was obviously a big thing amongst our class back then, or our group, music, the thing that brought us together. For some reason, there was like a group of us that was just, I'd been into music and kind of pop culture from when I was at primary school. And I just gravitated towards like-minded people, I guess, like-minded kids. And you and Richard and Lawrence Weaver has obviously got quite a big part in the story initially. You were the guys that I gravitated towards. And obviously I met Jenny at the same time as you and Rich as well, in 1979 on the infamous Nantes trip.
Music was kind of everything back then. But when I look back on it, for me, there's just very much this sort of clarity that we did 2 years at school and then we went off, and sort of punk rock happened during the summer that we went off. It had already been happening in 77. But, you know, maybe this is one of these false memories that you glamorize as you get older. But for me, it did feel very much that we had this sort of 6 weeks off school in the summer of 77. And we suddenly all came back and there was something to bond over, or indeed not to bond over if you were one of the sort of hard rock kids. Does that seem like a fair memory, John?
Yeah, I thought we bonded over music before that. But certainly, you know, I was quite good friends with Lawrence because of music before that. As you say, it was very much a heavy rock, prog rock kind of thing. And yeah, you're probably right, Tony, because obviously punk rock, you know, read lots about it subsequently and it happened very quickly. So it probably happened quite quickly for us as well.
Yeah, I feel like I remember sort of like swapping Deep Purple albums and probably talking about The Who and maybe about Thin Lizzy, which came up in conversation just the other day with my son, funnily enough, and things like that we were trying to bond over, but suddenly we had something real to bond over because suddenly the band's dropped a lot in age, and admittedly the stuff that was on Top of the Pops may not have been necessarily the coolest stuff around, but it certainly felt that way.
Yeah, I mean, I had two major influences, and you were certainly one, Tony, because you brought me into the Jam, and that really kicked it off. But I still have an older brother who's just 2 years older than me, and he was bringing in to my world John Peel on our radios at 10 o'clock at night, every night, and hanging out and listening to the new Sham 69 single or, you know, The Lurkers or something that he promised. Because Peel always said, oh, we've got the new single of so-and-so on, and we'd have to wait up all night to the end of the show to hear it. And so it was like this sort of stuff just kicked off all over the shop. And it was like everything came together in this sort of cacophony of, it was hormones as well as, you know, because it was such a massive social life, which was, I mean, when we were 14 and it all kicked off big time, particularly when that coach pulled up outside the school with all those girls on it. And then you had all this shit kicking off, which was not just music. It was like, there's girls, wow. You know? So it was an amazing moment in time where all these things came together. And all these people to whom this stuff was fundamental, because it was fundamental to our lives, right, Jen?
Absolutely. And I think as you guys were talking, I'm thinking I didn't get that with the girls in my class. You know, we're the same age. There wasn't anyone who was as excited about the new music as I was. They were still very much kind of Farrahs and Farrah Fawcett haircuts. Which obviously I could never do, but that kind of, I suppose, music for people who don't really like music.
Yeah,
it's the only way I can put it. It's that kind of middle of the road. Oh yeah, that's got a catchy thing, and just that would just annoy the hell out of me. And I was Top of the Pops was the only thing that I had at that time before I met you guys, I think, because it was a destination thing for 7 o'clock, 7:30 on a Thursday, that you had to watch it, no matter whether you had Rene and Renata followed by, you know, the Rizzillos or something. You snatched for the Rizzillos, or you snatched for the Jam, or you'd snatch for Elvis Costello. All of that stuff, because in between there was, you know, some kind of middle of the road and Pan's People, which, you know, apparently the dads liked or something. So, in their scantily clad costumes.
I think the kids liked them as well.
The boys.
You know, I'm realizing straight away, I'm not really expecting anybody under the age of about 40 to be listening to the podcast. But if any of our kids were going to listen, they'll be like, hang on, what? You didn't meet girls till you were 14, 15. What kind of school did you go to? And the answer is, we went to a sexually segregated school, because that's very much how the grammar school system was. And I think, without getting onto a tangent here, I think all of us probably felt like, oh, we did well by getting into a grammar school, which was essentially a, you know, still free education, but somehow sort of distinguished us. But what came with that was that you went to a boys' school or a girls' school. So added to all the...
And they were church schools.
They were
as well.
Church schools. So added to the fact that you were expected to recite the Lord's Prayer in the morning and sing hymns and nominally be Christian, was also this sense that, you know, you had a lot of teachers who were drawn from that. You had a lot of the sort of a certain degree of repression and even sadism from some of the teachers. And you were sort of sexually frustrated by the fact that, you know, you didn't mingle with the opposite sex whatsoever. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't take much to move into Monty Python territory, but that is what we grew up with. And that sort of also helped speak to why something like punk rock would have been so monumental, because we were growing up in that society. And then all of a sudden we weren't. All of a sudden, you know, you had your Susie Sues walking around and your Jordans walking around, and things seemed to change.
And your Debbie Harry.
And your Debbie Harry.
Debbie Harry.
Things seemed to change in an absolute heartbeat. Two of you have copies of the book, and actually mine didn't arrive yet. Jenny is holding hers up. Apparently it came out really well. It looks lovely from here.
It's It's bigger than I thought it was going to be.
They all say, Jen.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah, well, you kind of like invited it, Jenny. I'm sorry.
Walked into it. Yeah, I know. I walked into that. But it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful and full, absolutely full of everything. And I loved, you know, looking at the old covers. I still actually have some of my original jammings in this cupboard.
The thing is, as well, although it's sick and there's, you know, it's going to take an eternity to read it all, which I do intend to do, it still has the feel of a fanzine.
It does it justice. It does the whole jamming thing justice, I think. It just felt right, you know, and the thing about a fanzine was holding it in your hand, right, and looking at the way it had been put together and the punk way it had been put together, quite frankly, and it had a staple in it, you know, and that is a fanzine, right? And so jamming morphed into a magazine, right, because it was done, it looked different in its later years. But if you look at that book you're just holding up, Jen, it brings it all back. I mean, for those of us that were spraying, you know, the cover of, was it number five, was it, Tony, that we sprayed?
Yeah, it was number five, yeah.
Maybe the smell in your bedroom of the spray paint, you know, trying to, there you go. That actually, that cover says so, it's just, it is jamming, that cover. That, to me, is, the front cover of the book has got the stylized logo, etc. on it. But that picture of the spray paint, the photocopied photo, the sort of just the, it's a fanzine feel and beautiful. I love it. I just flick straight to issue number five.
Well, one thing I did want to try and do with the book that I think has been pulled off, I sort of tried to sell it to the publishers with the idea it would be a bit like one of those Christmas annuals you'd get when you bought Shoot or, you know, I was thinking more of those sort of Sport or the Beano or something, where you'd get just a bumper issue in your Christmas stocking or, you know, under the bed or under the Christmas tree. The idea that this is almost like one big giant issue of jamming. I do have to thank the three of you for each contributing something really, really nice that we ended up putting together at the front of the book. And it means a lot to me. And I think it's probably relevant to the times we lived in that we're not even the only four of us that are still close friends. There's a much wider group of us from school. And we did this without any old boy networks, without any sort of American style high school reunions. We've just stayed friends all our lives. I'm sure the music plays a massive, massive, massive part of that. Just before we started doing the started recording, John mentioned, you know, my original partner in the fanzine, back before it was called Jamming. And John, I had you kind of like write the first intro piece there, because sort of famously, or infamously, to the extent anybody really does care, when I had this sort of like idea of starting a fanzine, I asked you to do it with me because you had the coolest music taste in the class. I have a particular memory of it. What's your memory of how that played out?
I don't have a great memory of it, I must admit. You know, all I remember is thinking, no, I don't want to commit. For whatever reason, I didn't want to commit to jamming, which was obviously, you know, not one of my better decisions in life, I suppose. But rather than just being negative, I do remember Tony saying, you know, Lawrence is your man.
And so we're talking about Lawrence Weaver here, aren't we?
Yeah, we're talking about Lawrence Weaver. You know, Lawrence is your man, because Lawrence was also like a completely music mad kid, albeit his tastes were kind of the heavy metal persuasion. And he had, you know, quite long hair, even at that age. How old must he have been? About 14, I suppose.
Yeah, 13, 14. Yeah. So, yeah, that's my memory, is that I was reading this John Savage piece about fanzines and sounds. And thought fanzine sounds like a good idea. There's nothing more than that. Nothing, no, as I wrote right at the start of the book, no plan, not of any kind. Just like, oh, very entrepreneurial me, let's start a fanzine. John, you want to start the fanzine with me? Nah. ask Lawrence. Lawrence, you want to start
very
a fanzine
punk
with
rock,
me? Yeah,
it's let's very do punk it. Rock. It's like he's done it. Someone's talking about it. I'll have a go at that. Hey, look, there's a band playing. I could do that.
Yeah, no, I think that's. You know, so to really get over, Rich, it is. I mean, Tony, you were the one who actually, you know, obviously did it. But I think it's really important, especially at that age. You know, I think age is everything. It's unbelievable how much we were into music and how much you did when we were like 13, 14, 15. It was unbelievable. And I think obviously it helped living in London. My kind of memories at the time are kind of, it was kind of parties at the weekend with girls. But then during the week, we'd be, you know, at the age of 14, I'd be with you, Tony, and with you, Rich, you know, having a beer in the marquee, watching a band on on a school night. So school nights were reserved for night, you know, seeing bands with the lads, and then weekends for parties with hopefully with girls and stuff. But you know, at 14 and 15, that was a pretty crazy thing to be
thinking back. You know, you were able to go to those gigs, and well, you all know my mum. I wasn't getting anywhere, really. But I think I'm just wondering how much easier access it was for boys just to be able to do that stuff. I'd have loved to have been, you know, getting on that number three bus, going up to the marquee at 14.
The thing was as well, they were actually pretty violent times. You know, although we were like, you know, 14, 15, different kind of violence to the kind that takes place these days. But you know, gigs and football, which were kind of what we were into, basically, you know, you were pretty much guaranteed trouble.
And London was, you know, it was very tribal.
Yeah,
everything was so very tribal. And
we never let that stop us. You know, I think we still went to gigs. We still went all over London at all times of night. And, you know, any day of the week in pursuit of music and new bands and jamming was, you know, captured.
I remember saying to you a few years ago, Tony, absolutely, whether looking, because, you know, I was often and constantly really looking back on those years. And I remember saying to you, you know, what was it, you know, how special were those times? You know, not just in our micro world, but in macro terms, how special were they? And it's bloody obvious they were massive, right? And what's interesting about our world was that we had this concentration of people like Tony and Lawrence in particular, who really lived and breathed music. Now, that didn't happen in many places, right? We were in amongst quite a special group, as evidenced by, you know, jamming, Apocalypse, you know, what went on, particularly in your world, Tony, in your career. So I think we were really, really lucky. And, you know, I feel really, really fortunate to have been part of that journey. And at the time, we were like pissing about in your bedroom, doing stuff with the magazine, playing guitar. And I was, you know, all that stuff we were doing there, you know. It was incredibly precious and just like formative, you know, changed my life, absolutely shaped me as a person. Certainly my musical journey was started right there.
You know, one of the things that I think can be great about doing something like a jamming is the lack of planning, is the fact that you just do something and it happens and you don't have a game plan. And I think that's long to its credit. But running alongside that, you've raised something there, Richard, I'd be interested to ask all of us. Were we aware at the time that we were in a special situation, that we were really actually pretty bloody fortunate? We'd landed at the right place in the right time. We were living a life that maybe we were going to be able to bore our kids talking about 20 years, 30, 40 years down the line?
No, I think for me, I'd always been into music and I'd always lived in central London. So going to gigs was, you know, it wasn't enough for me just to listen to music. I had to see the bands live as well. So from that perspective, I didn't feel, I just thought it was normal. That's what people did. You know, if you were into music like we were, forgetting our, you know, completely oblivious to how old we were, if you were into music, then right, you might have trouble getting into gigs every now and again, which was a reminder. But, you know, that's what people did. So, no, I didn't feel it was that special or precious at all. I think as jamming grew, I think the first signs that I thought something felt a bit special was when your relationship with Paul Weller came along. And then suddenly, like, the Jam became the biggest band in the UK. And suddenly we were, you know, we were meeting Paul Weller and sitting in the classroom listening to records that the Jam had just recorded before they come out and stuff like that. So that's when it started to feel a bit special for me. You know, now looking back, I realise how lucky I was to have friends, you know, around me who were into music as well. And also lucky to be living in central London where bands played every night of the week.
Which, Jenny, that would be roughly the age that we met. And you write a couple of really nice things in the book. And there was a third piece you wrote that I think I just couldn't quite squeeze in there, which was about stapling and collating the fanzines on my bedroom floor. Mm. I mean, we struck a friendship. All four of us got to go on that trip to Nantes. So did Jeff Carrigan, who sent me a lovely email today. His book just arrived and he was knocked out by it as well. Jeff was my bandmate and very intrinsically involved in a whole number of issues of the fanzine. And he wrote a few things for the book as well, just some short memories, mainly about waiting for me 2.5 hours at a time, because that's what you did in the days before mobile phones. But Jenny, you kind of, you know, got to be part of that where we actually started putting the fanzine together on my bedroom floor, because, you know, that was all part of saving money. Just talk about that a little bit. Just share for other people this fanzine culture, that what we actually did back then.
Essentially, I would walk from my mum's flat. We lived about half a mile apart, something like that. And I remember the first time going to yours, because, you know, we must have had some sort of conversation about, well, do you want to come and help collate jamming? Well, yeah, I can collate. I didn't know I could write. I didn't know what else I could do that would be a contribution, but I could damn well help put the thing together and get it out there. So I remember coming round to your place, grand piano downstairs, and your mum had a broken leg. Yeah. And she was at the grand piano and just welcomed. I'm sure she just had this procession of Tony's friends going upstairs to do collating. Piles and piles of paper on a relatively modest sized bedroom. I mean, it's got to be, it's your, obviously your bedroom, your dressing room, your schoolwork room, your boys' bedrooms. I don't think I'd really been in one before, but anyway, so yours was the first.
I'm glad to have that honor.
There you go. And I do remember you had a midnight blue wall. Yeah. And there's just one midnight blue wall, and there were clippings and stuff all over it, and just, right, okay, so you say, right, we start from here, we start from left to right, collate all these, we've got X, Y, and Z, and we just kind of, you set up a little production line, except you're doing it on a bedroom floor with plimsolls and, you know, school books and a guitar and whatever else, and you just worked and got paper cuts and just kind of got this pile together. So then it's a case of, right, okay, how many can you take to sell at school? And then I got myself a reputation at school being hanging out with all the boys, and why do you think you're going to sell this here at our end of the grammar school? That's another point. And then so you kind of it's almost sale or return, but not sale or return, because you just try and keep them pristine. So if you're taking them to a gig, and there we are all underage at gigs, kind of shouting across noise to keep going on about, you know, do you want to buy a copy of Jamming? What's in it? We'll just look at the front cover. Oh, it's got Weller on the front, usually useful for mods at that point. And you try and sell it. It was 25p. They'd try and give you drugs instead, or, you know, try and barter in some way with beer or coins, or just try and take it off you. But you're trying to keep these things pristine because, well, they're worth 25 pence each and you need to sell them. I mean, I never felt any kind of pressure. It was to sell as such. It was just the joy of going, yeah, this is really good. There are some really good interviews in here. There's all sorts of bands in here. You should see it. What is it? Oh, it's a fanzine. Yeah, great. Because there are a few around, but none, obviously, that I thought was as good as Jamming.
Yeah, generally, what I've got in my mind, the image I've got in my mind is and it's almost like a caricature these days, Tony. It's you with an Adidas bag full of Jammings. Every day of your life, it was like every lunchtime you're on that tube going up to Rough Trade or Better Badges or something, and you always had... You always had a bag. We had school stuff in our bags. You had Jammings, right?
I remember that as well, Rich. And you know, in your piece in the book, that really hit home for me when I read that on Tuesday or whatever, doing the hour lunch round the record shops, because I did that with Tony as well. And that, you know, such great memories. Yeah, that, I found that quite emotional, to be honest. But yeah, I remember that. And I also remember Tony coming into school looking like shit on more than one occasion because he'd been up all night collating jammings or writing for jamming and stuff like that.
Yeah, there were a couple of, I mean, I learned to do all-nighters pretty early on and they killed me. I specifically remember the one for Jamming Six. I just remember falling asleep on the bus and I'd delivered the copy to the printers and I got on the bus to come into school and I just realised I couldn't do it. I could not do it. So I got off the bus and crossed the road and took a bus home and just went home and went to bed. Obviously didn't show up at school that particular day and the printers did a terrible job on that particular issue. This is not really the thing for you three, but that dealing with the printing was the hardest thing about the fanzine. It really wasn't till Jolly took me on that Jammit probably would have bit the dust. I just could not find a printer. I had the desire, I had the determination, I could even get hold of people to interview, but it was probably just going to come up against that same brick wall. And that made just such a difference. And that's when it probably did start getting to be like, yeah, let's go on the bus. You know, we can go to Better Badges. We can stop at Rough Trade. And if we're lucky, the jammer in the studio at the townhouse, that's all over West London way. The jam had a period where they almost expected teenage boys to drop by and hang out in the studio. And Richard, you do write in there about this is jumping ahead to jamming number nine, but that very hilarious interview we did with them when, you know, I think for, you know, as often the case, three or four of us went along. And I think you write in there that I went to interview the jam, Jeff, to take pictures. And what was your role again?
In those days, and some would say ever since, I was trying to look like Weller and still, probably still looking like Weller now. Got the right hair colour. So, yeah, so I just sat on the pool table looking cool, watching you do the interview. And it was like I was absolutely, I was probably just like a dumb zombie because it was completely overwhelmed. Never been in a control room before. They're my heroes there. They're playing this music which just sounds like absolutely awesome. And then we sit down and they're playing Space Invaders and Paul and we're having an interview. It's like, really? Is this really happening to me? It was truly awesome.
It should be pointed out that's the summer of 79. We've just turned 15. And
that's a really important point, the age of, you know, 15. Wow.
It is pretty remarkable. Although I often say to people, when a lot of people kind of trying to hit on the story, oh, you were 13 when you started this fanzine. I'm like, yeah, but really the point is I started it in 1977. If I'd been 16 in 77, I wouldn't have started the fanzine in 1974. I'd have started it in 1977 as a 16-year-old. I always maintain it was about the period, not how old we were. And the same about us going to gigs at 14 and 15. I think the reason that we went to the market, we would literally go home, change out of our school uniform, potentially keep our school blazers because they looked somewhat new wave. If you could get away without putting the school crest on them, which I would try and do. And then, you know, and then go up to the marquee to see the Undertones and the Rosillos. But that again is because that's what was on offer, not because we were trying to be precocious 14-year-olds. We didn't do it the year before because it wasn't on offer. Our 16, 17-year-olds couldn't do it 2 years before because that wasn't on offer. But certainly living in London, we had that advantage and a lot of it came for granted. I think we may have been part of a last sort of generation of where parents actually let us do this stuff before, to be quite honest, it started to become like that's actually not called parenting. We might have to report the parents for it. We were just allowed to do all of that. We just got away with it. And I think to our credit, individually, we never succumbed to darker forces. I think we were all so into music that the idea of like getting into drugs and stuff just didn't appeal. The odd pint of beer was enough for us, basically.
We didn't go out to get drunk. You'd go, all right, I'll have a drink. And it was, you know, you'd have two drinks all week or something. It was about the excitement of seeing the band, seeing your heroes or seeing a new band, whoever they were, just being able to get out and see bands and come out sweaty and exhilarated going, wow.
I think, you know, we're having a wonderful time talking about going to gigs and I feel very fortunate about that era, but it might not be so much for me to say, and maybe I'd like to ask you to say, jamming was far from the only fanzine around, certainly actually during the mod revival and for a period there were just dozens, hundreds. Can any of you kind of just talk about the relevance of fanzines to that period of time?
Pre-internet, magazines were everything. And even before punk, we lived by the weeklies. We used to read Sounds. Yeah, actually, in school, in class, we used to gather around Sounds and The Enemy and The Melody Maker, and pore over them, really, over news and over over interviews. But they did feel very much, you know, at a higher level than the writers didn't seem part of our... They're obviously older. It just felt as if they were older and more experienced. And when fanzines came along, people used to sell your fanzines at gigs and going into record shops. There were fanzines everywhere. You'd meet people that did fanzines. And it was basically the connection of, you know, you realise that these people were, or maybe a little bit older more often than not, but they were actually, you know, they were your peers. And it was a really good way of not only finding out information about the bands that you liked, but also connecting with bands that you didn't know about and you know, and like-minded people. And it was the way everyone beyond our little clique at school communicated. So yeah, hugely important.
I just think it just the way that the interviews were written in fanzines, obviously it's a, you know, there seemed to be something coming off the page from the bands who really were much more frank about themselves and what they liked, and funny as well. Much funny than you get. It just seemed more honest. You get a more honest response in an interview question that came from a fanzine rather than some muso journalist that was a proper grown-up.
The bands trusted the fanzine writers a lot more than maybe they, you know, the actual journals and the weeklies.
They knew it's coming from a fan place. Definitely. You know, these kids are really interested in our music. And that's, I mean, this is, you know, my adult head looking back on some of the things. And I still have original jammings that I've looked at from time to time. And you just go, there's an irreverence and stuff that you wouldn't get in a proper newspaper, because it wasn't about them trying to sell records necessarily. It was about trying to reach an audience who might like their music. And they had their manifesto, whichever way it was, they had what they had to offer. And to be able to speak to, you know, the 14, 15, 16 year old kids who were interviewing them, who were bold enough to go, actually, would you do an interview for my fanzine? Yeah, all right, come down the studio. I'll see you after a gig. Are you sure you're supposed to be in here? Because, you know, does your mum know? Oh, no, my mum's waiting outside in the car for me again. That kind of thing. But I think that you just get this honesty that wasn't available. Not saying that they were lying in the other, but it was much more kind of a corporate thing. And record companies were involved and all that sort of stuff.
And I think something that you just got me thinking about there, Jenny, we were touching previously very much on the jam, and I recognise that that's a common thread we all had. We loved the band, then they became the biggest band, and we were close to them, which is a pretty unique scenario all around. But John and I, in particular, John, you and I have always had, like, you know, very, very, very wide tastes. I think we've loved like a massive variety of music. And, you know, jamming also wrote about The Fall, and it also wrote about, like, Killing Joke and Delta 5 and Screedy Politti and all kinds of things. And I've often looked back on that jamming number 9, where there's the jam interview, but there's also the Fall interview. And I really, really liked that interview with The Fall, which actually was done at their record company, but, you know, it was an indie label. And there's something about that particular interview that speaks to what you just mentioned, Jenny, this sort of the irreverence. And the fact that Mark E. Smith liked it enough that he wrote to me afterwards and said, you know, that it just sort of was that honest. He just really enjoyed reading it, and it even made him rethink his attitude towards the jam being in the same issue. And I was always kind of quite proud that when you looked at the readers' charts in jamming, that the Jam and The Fall and Joy Division would share sort of number one spots. And I always, like, you know, that sort of no subtitles for us that I put in when I was putting this book together, I was kind of like, yeah, I'm not quite sure where that came from. I think there was some lyric that The Fall had that made me think of that. And so I put in a subtitle, no subtitles for us. It just seemed very, very Fall. And the sort of the irreverence and the fact that groups would agree to interviews, I always liked that there was this different sort of structure to the fans. And Jenny is holding up copies of this book that I don't yet have, but I am familiar with the pages. It looks very nice in print. All credit to Omnibus for doing such a great job with this. Anyway, did that make any sense to you, what I'm saying there about all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say Definitely. What I was going to say was the relevance and the significance of fanzines. I mean, the clue's in the name, of course, as you said, Jen, but the significance is it was such a complementary aspect of punk, right? Because it was about just doing it, just getting on and doing it, and just be very front and center with it, and no bullshit. It was just, this is the way it is. And it gave other people an outlet and an inlet to that punk and new wave music, right? There was those that wanted to be in the bands and could be in the bands and just did it, others that were fans, others that wrote about it, others that read about it. You know, it was all just part of that pre-internet world, John, you mentioned, right? That we couldn't just look it up online and delve in. It was just a really important part of the culture of punk and new wave.
And I do remember fanzines, you know, around that time being of hugely varying quality. You know, you had kind of fanzines that, correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, like in the city, I remember reading in the city, which was quite a, you know, quite a, almost a magazine, although it was a fanzine, you know, and then you'd go in Rough Trade and you'd have like just one page, you know, an interview with someone that, you know, that was just like four sentences or whatever. That's kind of my memories of it. Lots of variety and lots of varying degrees of quality.
Yeah, and I think that's true of the indie scene in general. You know, you get all these indie records. I was lucky enough to start getting sent them, or I'd go into Rough Trade and they were kind enough to start giving me records. You know, this would happen and they would be of enormous, very quiet. Actually, Richard, I can't let this go without, I have a distinct memory. It might be down the line a little bit, probably to when we were about 16. Maybe I'd left school and you would come around to me at lunchtime because you could meet your girlfriend from, I think she would take a break from her school and you'd come around and spend your lunch hours with me. And I do remember, I think it was Killing Joke, but it could have been anything. I remember playing a record and you're saying something to me like, God, you do half listen to some shit.
Yeah, that'd probably be.
That sounds like a very heard statement. Yeah, indeed.
My objective views were quite clear. I wasn't beating about the bush. Actually, I thought I was a little bit more delicate than that. I was obviously feeling very self-assured at that point.
Well, you were in general, and while we're being all sentimental and stuff here, and some of this overlaps to the memoir that all three of you are featured in as well by your real names, Boy About Town. I mean, you know, Richard, you did coin that phrase that really summed me up in the proverbial nutshell. Tony, for you, school is just an occupational hazard of being young.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it was very poetic, actually. You kind of maybe hit on the wrong career. You should be a lyricist.
But actually, when you think about it, you were ahead of your time, and I'm not trying to just big you up here, but it's you were able to sort of somehow through your maturity and your vision that, you know, this was just, we just did this stuff, and we're like, well, certainly from my point of view, you know, we were good mates. I listened to you and I looked at what you were doing and thought, you know what, he's doing all right, and we were just getting on with life. And yeah. you were the guy with the Adidas bag full of jammies getting on the tube at lunchtime. We were going to cricket, right? Or we were, you know, or we were sitting in the common room. And so you were that phrase, you know, it was actually just an occupational hazard. You just worked around it, right? You just worked around school and just did what you were doing. You had your career going.
Absolutely, that, you know, and I still think from time to time, how did this boy have the confidence just to just go, well, but to actually start to get somewhere and for adults to respond positively? And you just seem to always have this thing of, well, I've got an interview with so-and-so, or do you want to come along? Well, you know, you find yourself just sort of tagging along as Tony's mate at times, which is, yeah, absolutely bloody cool, because you got to see people. But where did you find the confidence to do that at such a young age? That has always intrigued me.
You know, it's really strange. I was actually talking about this to my younger son, literally, this morning. The self-promotion is just something that you have to do. But it's okay to be shy about self-promotion. You just have to do it. And the strange thing is, I feel like nobody believes this. I would go into record shops and stand there for like 10 minutes trying to work up the confidence to go up to the counter and say, and open up that Adidas bag and say, I do a fanzine. Would you sell a copy? And 40 years down the line, those same people who worked at the counters, because funny enough, some of them went, not surprisingly, went on to become musicians and have contributed to the book, have thought of me as a supremely confident kid. And so there's this real like dichotomy. I remember just like quaking in my boots half the time, working up the confidence. But somehow I would be like, well, I came this far. There's no point walking into this shop and then backing out at the last moment. I'd better go up and do this. So it's a very, very, very strange thing. I think I just realized that if you're going to put a fanzine together, you have no choice but to sell it. So you're going to just have to work up the confidence. And sometimes at gigs, I wouldn't have the, I would just realize this gig is, I'm not going to sell a fanzine here. I'd ask two people and they tell me to F off and I'd be like, it's not the right place. Mm. Other gigs you'd start and somebody would go, yeah, I'll buy a copy. And then people would come up to you and you could afford to be confident. It's a very, very strange one. When I look back on that, I did not actually feel as confident as I realized I must have come across.
Maybe unlike the kind of music thing where, you know, it would have happened anyway, maybe age was a factor there.
And I think one thing is that genuinely, older people, yeah, I think really and truly, you have to be a little bit of a dickhead to turn your back on a young kid who comes up with a fanzine and wants a 5 minutes of your time.
Especially with such an angelic face.
Oh, well, thank you, Jenny. Is that my current face or the one I had back then?
The one you had back then.
Damn. Ah, it was worth a try, wasn't it? Well, it was worth trying, but I still feel that way, and I feel that way. I'm fortunate enough to work with some kids on music now, and I just feel like that's a big part of what you give back. You know, it's important to do that. Mm. To the extent that sometimes we had rock stars would give us interviews, I think they thought, well, I used to knock on somebody's door as well and hope for the time of day. And I think it's really important that people do give a little bit back. Now, we could obviously, we've done this many a time over pints when we managed to get together on trips. We could talk about this ad infinitum. We're going to have to wrap it up, but I thought I'd maybe ask for just a couple of favorite memories. Maybe is there a specific gig that each of you remember, perhaps to root it in the 70s before we would have turned maybe 16? Is there like a specific gig that you look back on and go, wow, I managed to get to that gig?
The one gig that I think we were all at was the Jam at the Music Machine.
Which
and
one?
We were all back.
But which one?
Well, I only remember one, and I remember we were all there, I think, and Mark Blakemore was there. There was a whole bunch of guys from school there, and we were backstage, Tony, and I had my best jam shoes, my short jeans and my white socks, and it was the whole part. And I remember being in the dressing room, and Foxton was moaning about not being able to go for a shit without anyone following him around. But I remember being pretty pissed. And then they started playing in the city about three or four songs in. I was sort of standing back because you remember the Music Machine was quite a bit of a pit, wasn't it, that you used to go into. And that was it. That was me down the front for the rest of the gig. It was just absolute. It always springs to mind just because of the opening chords of In the City.
Well, I'm thinking there's the two I have. Again, because the Jam was so central to, you know, they were the band I've seen most in my life, right? And the Jam at the Rainbow, when Apocalypse got their first support slot, what I remember is obviously Apocalypse more for having things thrown at them from the audience. Toilet rolls. I mean, I don't think there were anything more, you know, harmful than toilet rolls. But thinking, this is November 1980. The Rainbow, you just turned 16 and you're on stage supporting the Jam. I think Rich had kind of honorary band manager status that night.
I was a tour manager at that point, and I tour manager were blagging away in the back door in the stage door, if you remember, because they wouldn't let us all in because we came mob-handed.
So that but personally, well, I don't think any of I didn't go with any of you guys. I think I went with Paul and Craig from around the corner, seeing the Jam at Brixton and at what was called the Fair Deal, but now the Academy. You know, been going to gigs there forever. and in its other guises as a cinema as a small child. But the getting down to the front and that hot, sweaty, and it's mainly boys at a jam gig. You know, the girls are smattered about, but it is quite a male-dominated thing. And also, there weren't many black girls in the audience. I was obviously just kind of people, but we're like finding it strange that I knew all the words to stuff. But anyway, but getting right down to the front, just wiggling your way all the way down to the front. You're in the front, feel the crush of the crowd behind you, waiting for the band to come on. John Weller comes on and introduces, "Here we are, this is a jam." I'm not, obviously not a terribly good impression, but straight on, and they just stride on stage, strike up Strange Town. My feet did not touch the ground. Swayed from one side of the stage to the other, being held up by your shoulders, singing For All You Worth, thinking, will my feet ever touch the ground again? And having the best time of my life. And that was it. Just sweaty, mascara everywhere, hair frizzed out to nothing. But you come out of there and it is just the most exhilarating, oh my God, that's one of my favourite.
What about you, John?
I think two gigs stand out, both at the Marquee, special memories of a special place, really. I think that was amazing, the one in Wardour Street. But seeing the Jam now, when it was the John's Boys,
yeah,
that was pretty special, you know, talking to Paul Weller before they went on stage and stuff. And then, the chaos that ensued afterwards, having to kind of escape from the West End, you know, terrible. And also, then going back to what you were saying, Tony, about, you know, having varied musical tastes, when we went to see the Human League at the Marquee, you know, and I remember I was dressed as a mod. I used to love the Human League and Spiz, who played as well. And I was dressed as a mod, and I remember getting some punks through a bottle at us in Wardour Street. I remember that. But then just going into the Marquee, which I was familiar with, and then just seeing something completely different, you know, like the Human League playing synthesizers and having the projection and Phil Oakey looking like an alien. You know, I remember being there with you and, two very special gigs.
Yeah, the Marquee was special because it was the one place that would let us in. I think that's really important to note. We occasionally went further afield and it was just like, no, this is a pub. You're not 18. You can't get in. I do remember one time, and it may have been actually even at the John's Boys gig, that the manager of the Marquee came over. We bought pints and he came over and took the pints out of our hands. And he took me to a corner and went, I'll ever catch you drinking here again, underage. You know, you're banned from here. You're like, you're welcome here. Do not embarrass me like this. And he was really stern because he was like, we let you lot into the gigs. Don't blow it. Don't blow it. And I think that was like really, really important because we could get into the Marquee and we knew we could. So we could afford to buy tickets. It was legal to be, you know, to be able to go to the Marquee. That was really, really important. I think the one extra one I would throw in that is I just have particularly fond memories of the Rizzillos and the Undertones from what would have been about October 78. I was never been as crushed in all my life as I was for that Rizzillo's show. I was begging to be pulled out of the crowd and on the front row, and nobody would pull me out of the crowd. And the fact that we a couple of us walked backstage after the Undertones gig, or before the Undertones gig, and they showed us how to play, showed me how to play Teenage Kicks on the guitar. And that to me just sums up the whole fanzine DIY era. The Undertones looked about a year older than us because they were from Northern Ireland. We probably look more fashionable than them. They were happy to show us how to play the song. They'd just been on Top of the Pops like that night or the night before or whatever. The Rizzillos were on Top of the Pops. It was just beautiful, beautiful memories. And of course, both those records sound so Teenage Kick still sounds great. First Rizzillos album still sounds great. So that's something I particularly cling to as a moment of great fortune. But all of it, I just feel very fortunate, really. I just feel incredibly fortunate to be part of that period. Mm.
Remember being in the Marquee, and the Marquee had, you know, the black stone walls, and every time I went there, there was sweat dripping down, you know, the walls. Yeah. You know, the floor was obviously very sticky and very slippery with beer, but the walls were just as slippery. It was just, you know.
And you tried not to get pushed up against the wall in the Marquee. Yeah.
And it's nice that we can think back to that because, John, you're absolutely right about the John's Boys gig and the violence that followed. If I'm not wrong, because this might be a great place to actually leave this, did you not escape that night? You made your way around out that night with Guy Pratt. Is that right?
Yeah, I did indeed. Yeah, yeah. Obviously, I met Guy that night.
Yeah.
near you. I think he was in Speedball at the time.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
And he lived in Waterloo. So, you know, not far from where I lived, just at the borough at the time. So, we took turns in, because when we came out, Waldorf Street was all cordoned off and stuff. So we literally, you know, we were running up to the next, or kind of sneaking up to the next corner. And then one of us would look around the corner and go, all clear. And then like, it was like, you know, it's like a cartoon. But yeah, we worked our way through Covent Garden and got home.
Yeah, the nice way to leave that is Guy's going to take part in one of these podcasts himself, actually, and maybe the next one up. So I'll have a chance to pick up where we left off, which might be a perfect place to leave this. The journey for me was a collective journey. I mean, I know people associate me with the fanzine, but I'm so glad you all wrote something for the book. It was collective.
And, thanks for asking us.
Yeah, it really was. Absolutely. It was part of a culture, and I'm so glad that we not only took that journey together, but that we're all still alive, and that you were all kind enough to write something for the book. And I think what you wrote will all resonate as well. So thank you for that.
To actually have this tome compendium come out, it kind of confirms what we knew all along. That it was a special time.
Very precious, Tony. Precious times.
Do you want to buy a copy of Jamming?